quantum gravity, which is that in the case of quantum gravity, we would like to compute a set of transition amplitude. Between data that encode the physical aspect of the gravitational field. So that is, you want to start by your initial data being the, you know, a given manifold that I will call sigma, and a given metric which is on this manifold, and you know the out data is another manifold equipped with a given other metric. So in general, you know, it could be the manifold could have a simple topology, or in general a more general topology, and you would like to be able to compute transition amplitude where the topology, you know, the space-time topologies of the form sigma across I, if sigma in and sigma out are the same, or maybe you can, or you would like to want to explore maybe a topology change. Okay, so given this data, what you would like to compute, and let me be formal in the beginning, what you would like to compute is some transition amplitude.
Or sorry, I need to take it. The battery. Sorry for that.
So a set of transition amplitudes, which essentially amounts to Einstein action. Where the Planck length that arise here is a pi g h bar. Information. Okay, so this integral is extremely formal, and one of the main problems of the quantum gravity is to be able to define such. Such transition amplitude. So the first attempt, as you know, is to try to split the metric into a background metric and a perturbation metric. Essentially, you keep a background, a classical background, and the perturbation around is treated as a quantum field, and you treat this perturbation, and you treat this quantum fluctuation field in perturbation theory. As you know, it doesn't really work out because the theory is non-renormalizable. And I guess there's maybe two ways, and maybe more, to interpret this problem of non-renormalizability. So one way, which has been historically the most followed, is to say, well, here I'm making an assumption. I'm trying to expand my metric as a classical background and quantum fluctuation in the context of Einstein-Hilbert action on dynamics. So maybe, in fact, I got the dynamics wrong. Maybe there is, in fact, more degrees of freedom. And the Einstein-Hilbert action is just some type of effective field theory. Is an effective action, and I should really look for a more fundamental theory which contains more degrees of freedom and for which this effective theory arises some low energy limit. So that's more or less what string theory is proposing. And there's a more fundamental theory behind. So here, what you're criticizing is somehow you're changing the dynamics, right? You change, you propose to really change the dynamics of the theory. Another point of view is to say, well, maybe, you know, I made some type of hypothesis. The hypothesis I made is that I'm assuming that I can really safely treat this theory as a perturbation theory around, let's say, flat background around the classical geometry. But on the other hand, I know that GR is about to tell me, GR is about the dynamics of space-time geometry, right? So GR is a theory that is supposed to tell me, so it's about the dynamic of space-time. So GR is supposed to tell me what is exactly the correct notion of geometry at the quantum level. At this level, when you have a physical theory which has a dynamic and you quantize it, in some sense, the result of the quantization process is the answer you're looking for. It's telling you exactly how you should think about the essential and fundamental degrees of freedom of your theory. So what is the geometry at the Planckian level? So it's more a question. And you can say, well, maybe the assumption I made that I can safely think that I have a classical background, you know, at all possible energy level, at all possible short distance scales, is an assumption. In fact, it's an hypothesis by my theory which is in conflict with my dynamics. So I have a conflict between an hypothesis and a dynamical principle. I could either change the dynamical principle or be more conventional in trying to say, well, maybe, in fact, the place where it goes wrong is from the initial hypothesis that I try to suppose what the geometry of space-time is really, and then I got a wrong answer. Maybe my guess was wrong. So in this context, what you would like to do is try to build up a theory that tells you exactly how you should think about the geometry of space-time at the Planckian level. And essentially, this is what it means to be having a background independent approach. Okay, so maybe there's a, you know, other way to describe that, and what maybe the problem, you know, the marginal theory is a mixture of the two. There's also the point of view that Martin Rotter just presented, which is maybe not so clearly, it's not clearly the first one, and it's in some sense the second one, but it's maybe milder. It looks a bit milder than what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that naively, what we'd expect, quantum gravity has a fundamental scale, which is the Planck scale, so we expect something drastic to happen at this scale, and making any assumption to, you know, what exactly happens is going to it's going to be in conflict with our dynamics. And this is a problem that we don't have in any other type of free theory, because in any other type of free theory, the dynamics of the theory doesn't touch really what is the background space-time. So it's really clear in any type of free theory what is our background. In electrodynamics, you know, zero electric field is a good background. Whereas in gravity, zero metric is a weird background. Okay, so another point which is, so this is a generality, another point which is worth emphasizing is that when you write down such a transition amplitude, what could come in mind in first place is the usual transition amplitude that you get in quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, a transition amplitude is a matrix element between matrix element of a unitary evolution operator between initial and finite time, right? Of some unitary evolution operator, exponential ith. And if you take the limit where the time is big, this is, you know, the S matrix that we use in phi theory is the same type. So now the problem is that in gravity, when you do this integration over all a possible metric, there is effectively an integration over all possible time. So this contains integration of all possible time, proper time elapsed between the initial and final surface. Because when you vary a possible metric and you send a light signal from in to out, you're also varying the time elapsed between initial and final surface. proper time between, you know, sigma hat here. A way to see that is that if you call this amplitude A, and if you write it in the Hamiltonian formalism, so you can write it as integral over a three-dimensional metric, integral over the conjugate momenta, and the action will be pi g, gij dot minus, and the action in first-order formalism will contain, let's say, a lapse function minus a shift function, where the lapse and the shift are component of the metric that you get when you expand in the Dan-Meyer. This is the lapse term. This is the metric term. Nj dt. And Pij is related to the explicit curvature, as Thomas was explaining us. So this object, we know that the integral over, you know, path integral in this form all amounts to, and of course there will be also, sorry, component of the metric, which are the lapse and the shift, which are integrated over. So if I use the usual formal argument about path integral, integrating this object is the same as integrating between an initial state and an outgoing state. The operator, you know, corresponding to the Hamiltonian constraint and the operator corresponding to the diffeomorphism constraint. So you can think that what this operator here is doing is essentially replacing this, and there will be an integral over dn and dni. So integrating over all shift amounts really to integrate over all possible diffeomorphism on the boundary. So just going to tell you that the amplitude depends only on the diffeomorphism class of this amplitude. And then what you're computing is some type of Hamiltonian operator, but where you are still left with the integral over all possible lapse between the initial and final surface. And of course, this contains the proper time elapsed between the two, because if you look at what is the proper time going between the initial and final surface, this is going to be the integral between 0 and 1, dt of, you know, n dt along a path which is such that dxi is equal to ni dt. Okay? So, you know, fixed time-like path. So what you're really computing here is some type of formal, let me write it here, matrix element of, if I'm really formal, you know, the delta function of H. So that is a projector operator that projects onto the space of physical states. The proper way to describe that is what Thomas was describing yesterday, that is, it's a ringing map. But essentially, what this amplitude is computing, the gravity amplitude is computing, is really the matrix element of the, let me call it the projector, but you should read the ringing map onto the physical Hilbert space. Okay, so this is the physical scalar product. Oops. And that's what I'm interested into, and that's what I want to compute with spin form. There's something that one should say, is that in fact there's different type of amplitude that I can compute in quantum gravity. The first one is really the one I'm saying, that is, I integrate over all possible initial data and final data, but I don't really care about whether the final data is in the past or the future of the initial data. So that is, this integral contains really an integral over dt going from minus infinity to plus infinity, exponential it, the Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's the first. Compute the physical, the projector. The second option that you can do in the Lorentzian case, and which is in fact harder, is to say, well, no, I want to compute only the causal amplitudes between initial and final data, where I restrict the integration to be such that the out metric is always in the future of the out space, is always in the future of the in space. Okay, so I take this integral over all positive proper time. This is a causal amplitude. And the third thing you could try to do, which the physical interpretation of this one, the concept of gravity, is not clear. The first one is really clear. You're computing the physical scalar product. This one is, you know, I think physically more motivated, but the correct interpretation is not completely clear. At least to me. This is a type of Feynman propagator, if you want, the space of metric. And the third one is to say, okay, here I've talked about Einstein-Hilbert, and I've not specified, I had in mind the Lorentzian action, but it's very convenient sometimes to think in terms of Euclidean quantum gravity. And the problem is that there is two types of quantum gravity. So in the literature, there's two ways, or there's, let's say there's, I'm going to distinguish Euclidean quantum gravity from Riemannian quantum gravity. The Euclidean quantum gravity is the idea that, well, maybe I should use a first Euclidean metric, G Euclidean, and a real weight, exponential minus S, with the Euclidean action. Okay? Having in mind that there exists maybe some type of weak rotation that relates this Euclidean quantum gravity to the quantum gravity, as it is the case, for instance, for the relativistic particle. The problem is that, well, first, as we have seen, there's this problem of the conformal mode. It doesn't really make sense to talk about that. The action is unbounded from below. There's a priori no evidence that there's any relationship between the two, but maybe there is. Maybe there's a way to make sense of that, and that would be extremely good to have that. But a priori, when you're doing Euclidean quantum gravity, the interpretation here then is completely, totally unclear, at least to me, and I think to a lot of people in the field. So now there's the notion of Riemannian quantum gravity. That is, you can try to still, to understand what quantum gravity is, you can try to still integrate over all metric, but you still keep the I coefficient there. The idea is that you can't really get rid of the I coefficient because you see it appears here. And the problem is that the Hamiltonian that arises here is not a positive Hamiltonian. So that's one way to see that the Euclidean version. So when you put a minus there and you integrate over positive lapse, a function which is not positive, you don't really know what you're doing. But if you put an I here and this object is not positive, it doesn't really matter. You can put an I epsilon prescription, or you can integrate over all lapse and compute a projector operator. Okay, so, and that you can do also in the case of Riemannian quantum gravity, that is, try to understand what the theory is with respect to Riemannian metric. And in spin form model, so we are looking at really this object and this object. And people have, you know, the idea is that it's not clear that there's any relationship, there's no weak rotation expected between the Riemannian quantum gravity and the Lorentzian one, but at least you can start to do lots of things and understand what's going on. Okay, so that's some type of generality here. Let me put here maybe the plan of the talk as I, can I? Is there a more efficient way to erase? So this is the only eraser? What? That. Why? What?
The blue thing, which is not the eraser, is the best eraser.
It's the best eraser, okay.
Just put the black one as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's physical. I mean, you ski in the morning and you do some exercise in the afternoon. Okay, prevents you from writing too much. Now I'm okay. I'm going to talk much more. okay.
So, yeah. Sign somebody to help you.
In that, yeah. Okay, yeah. If somebody can help me to do that while I'm doing some talking. Okay. Thank you. But Thomas, I mean, maybe I'm weaker than Thomas. Thomas was able to do that very efficiently.
As well as
Okay. Okay, so at what time did I start? 4:15, right?
16:00.
Okay. So I want to talk about, after these generalities, I want to talk about spin networks. And in this lecture, I'm also going to introduce the notion of spin networks. And before introducing spin foam, I think I'm going to have to do a lot of group theory, explain you what an intertwiner is, a Hall measure is, what you can do with it, because this is type of technology which is maybe standard to some people. It's kind of elementary. It's far from quantum gravity, but we use it a lot. So I want to be sure that everybody knows what I'm talking about in the future. So I'm sorry for the people who know that. Then the next session, I'm going to talk about spin foam models per se. And you know, a general introduction and some properties about it. But I would be very general there. And then I want to focus, to make things concrete, in fact, I want to focus on one model, one quantization of quantum gravity that we know how to do exactly within this context of spin foam model. And in fact, it's, well, this language allows you to go much farther than any other language allowed you to go into in the context of 3D gravity. So I'm going to introduce the notion of 3D gravity and present the classical theory, which is property, and the quantum model, which is called the Ponzano-Régé model, which is the oldest model of quantum gravity ever written, 1968, but it's the one which really works. And it's the first example of a spin foam model. And the idea is that I want to focus on an example to show you what you can do there, what type of question you can ask. And of course, there are many things you can extend to 4D, and I guess Cetera Levin will talk about some of the things, but I want to be very concrete to show you how, in one model, you can really select the amplitudes, give a definition of these amplitudes, and then extract some physical results. I will talk about Ponzano-Régé model, the notion of symmetries. And then in order to extract a physical observable, I'm going to use the fact that, in some sense, if I do only pure gravity, it's very hard to extract physical information. What I need to do is to couple it to matter. So I want to describe the coupling to matter. Okay. And if I have enough time in the last lecture, I'm going to talk about how, in fact, when you can, in this context, integrate out quantum gravity and construct an effective field theory description of matter field coupled to quantum gravity. That comes out from quantum gravity. So spin foam model, because that's what I'm going to about, is what? It's an attempt to define this amplitude in the context of loop quantum gravity. Okay. What loop quantum gravity is telling you in the first place is exactly what are the analogous initial and final data you should put. That is, in the Willer-De Witt formulation, the initial data are functional, wave functional of the space-like metric in the initial surface. Now, in the context of loop quantum gravity, I guess Thomas will talk about some related thing. What happens is that these initial states at the kinematical level is replaced by what we call spin networks. Okay, so what is a spin network? And the rest of the talk is about to be about defining properly all the notions I'm using here, right? So these spin networks are useful because, as you will see, I guess in Thomas' talks, they are eigenstates of geometrical operator. So they really describe properly the notion of quantized geometry. You define some geometrical operator and you're trying to look for possible eigenstates. They are generically functions of not the metric, but functions of the connection, either the Hdkar-Barbero connection in 4D, Barbero connection, or in 3D, in 4D, this is the case, or in 3D, the usual spin connection. The nice thing is that in both cases, in fact, this is a SU2 connection, so you can have a common language to talk about 3D and 4D gravity. So what is let's say, an abstract spin network? An abstract spin network, gamma with a coloring, is a graph, gamma, which carries some coloring such that with edges of this graph are colored by SU2 representation. So this is an abstract SU2 spin network. You can generalize the notion to any group representation. That is spins, and vertices are colored by SU2 intertwiners. And I'm going to explain that later. Now, given an abstract spin network, you can talk about an embedded spin network. Which is that you take the same data, but you embed it into your space-like manifold. Also, well, there's the notion of an oriented spin network, which is the same thing except that you give an orientation to every edge of your little graph there. So why are spin networks interesting? Why am I talking about? It's because given a spin network, you can define a spin network allows you to define a spin network functional which is a function, spin network functional phi, gamma, depending on this coloring, edges and intertwiner, is a functional that assigns to a product of group elements. So let's say E is the number of edges in my graph, GE1, GEN. I assign this function phi gamma G1, GEN. So this is a spin network functional which carries some gauge invariants that I'm going to explain. And once I have a notion of spin network functional, I can naturally construct a functional of the connection. If I have an embedded, if I have an oriented spin network, I can construct a spin network functional. And if I have an embedded oriented spin network, I can construct a natural functions of the connection, A. by just taking my spin network functional and taking as a group element associated to the edge E the holonomy, the group element GE is just going to be the order of the exponential or the holonomy of the connection along the edge E. Okay?
Sorry.
Yes?
Could you just explain what the spin network function was?
So I'm going to explain that. So, okay. So I'm going to, part of the rest of the talk is to explain to you how you construct the spin network functional. Okay? One property of the spin network functional is the fact that if I have a graph gamma, there's a notion of gauge invariance. So suppose this is my graph gamma. I have a vertex 1, a vertex 2. There's a notion of gauge invariance, which is that, in fact, you have a natural action of a copy of the gauge group, a copy of the group at each vertex, which is acting on this data. That is the copy of the gauge group for each edge. So I have a group action like that. And the spin network functional is the spin network functional I obtained from a spin network, phi GE, is invariant under this. This action. So for instance, if I take the simplest, let's say, spin network I can think of, one vertex, one edge, so I have only one group element, and the gauge invariance I'm talking about is a gauge invariance where, in general, I have an edge here, and I have a starting vertex and a terminal vertex, and the gauge invariance is just that the group element GE is transformed by S, SE minus 1, GE, S, TE. Okay, so I conjugate by an action at the initial vertex and an action at the final vertex. So for instance, in that case, since the initial and final vertex are the same, this is just the adjunct action. If I take, for instance, this graph, the theta graph, I have two vertex, and I have three group elements, G1, G2, G3, and the action is just that, I have, if I orient them like that, 1, 2, the gauge invariance I'm talking about is an action at the vertex 1 and at the vertex 2. Okay, and to end up with the generality, spin networks are interesting, not only because I can construct spin network functional from there, but in fact I have a theorem, and I hope I will be able, let's say, to prove it today, which is the following, is that if I look at a given Hilbert space, given a graph gamma, I can construct a given Hilbert space, which is the space of all L2 function of E, a group element where E is the number of edges of this graph, divided by the action of my gauge group. So I'm looking at the space of all possible gauge invariant functions, which are normalizable, L2 with respect to the R measure on the group. And this space is the same as the direct sum of all possible coloring of my graph, that is all possible spin networks. So it is any, it's so the spin network form a complete orthonormal basis of this space. So that's why we are interested into spin networks, because I'm interested into functions of the connection, right? But if I assume that the connection depends only on the data along a graph, then such type of functions are in fact, cyclically just, if they are normalizable, are just spin network functional. And by varying the graph, and I have access to all possible gauge invariant functional of the connection. And that's, Thomas is going to be more precise on that. So, so clearly I have to explain to you what I mean by, okay, maybe a representation, that's going to be easy, intertwiners, and more precisely, how you do this mapping, and eventually, how you prove this, let's say, main theorem that we use, that these two spaces are the same, that the spin network form a complete basis. Okay, so if I start with maybe, okay. So let me do, so I'm going to do now some basic, in order to prove all of that, I'm going to do some basic representation theory of SU2. Okay, so SU2 is the group of 2x2 matrices, unitary 2x2 matrices. The Lie algebra, you know, is generated by, let's say, diagonal matrices and sigma plus and sigma minus, which satisfy this this algebra and sigma plus sigma minus equal H. Okay, so H is diagonal matrix, sigma plus is the element which has and sigma minus is the element which has a zero, a one here. Okay, and H is one. So we're interested in finite dimensional representation. We're interested in finite dimensional representation because in the case of a compact group, they are going to be a unitary representation. So in the case of simple compact groups, there's an equivalence between, if you have a finite dimensional representation, you can always construct a scalar product such that the representation is unitary, and then the reverse is a bit complicated, but there's kind of equivalence, and the unitarity is in fact important for us there. Well, I'm supposing that you know a bit of representation, but the general theory of representations is that you start from H and you say, well, I have a vector, you know, any representation is going to be to diagonalize my object H. So I can suppose that I have a basis which is like that. And because of this commutation relation, then because I'm supposing that the representation is finite dimensional. If I look at the action, for instance, of sigma minus, the action of sigma minus changed the weight by units. M goes to M plus 1, and minus 1, and minus 2, etc. Because it's finite dimensional, I necessarily have a highest weight, something where I count, where I get 0 when I act with sigma plus, and then I get all the representation by going down the ladder like that. Okay? And then I can adjust the proper factor such that the basis I'm using is orthonormal basis. And it's good to do the exercise by yourself. Maybe you have read in book, but do it by yourself, because all representation theory of all simple groups and even lots of non-compact groups use again and again the same basic idea. Even representation of Fock space, you start from a vacua, which is highest weight with respect to A dagger, and you create all excitations by acting with A there. Okay, so... Okay, maybe there's no need to write down the action of generator on the finite dimensional representation. Of course, such representations have dimension 2j plus 1. So the only place where you can have, yeah, what you can show is that the highest weight here is, should be such that the highest weight I can get in the representation should be an integer, and so j is a half integer if I want to... finite dimensional representation. So when I have a notion of finite dimensional representation, there's something which is always useful, is that there's always the notion of dual representation, or it's sometimes called contragradient, or conjugate, depends on where you, who you talk to, mathematician, physicist, particle physics, mathematical physicist. And essentially, if the matrix element, I'm going to denote the matrix element of a group element G in the, you know, of a group element J in the representation, group element G in the representation J, and like that. Then the matrix element of the contragradient representation G, M, N, is just the transpose inverse of this one. And M. Okay, and it's a natural object because the contragradient representation admits a natural duality bracket between the representation and the initial one. So that is, that means that there's a mapping like that between VJ and VJ star, which intertwine these two representations towards the trivial one. And when I say intertwine, I'm beginning to use the notion of intertwine, it means that this mapping respects the action of the group. So if I act on the group here and here, nothing happens. And essentially here, it's clear that I'm using just a unitarity of the representation. The thing which is special in SU2 and that helps a lot in this construction is the fact that a priori the dual representation for a general group is different from the original representation, but in the case of SU2, there's a simplification that the dual representation is isomorphic as a representation, to the initial one. And essentially the mapping is just that you take the vector m, the vector weight m, and you map it to the vector minus 1 j minus m times m. So it means that there is an invariant pairing between vj and vj. Okay? And I'm going to use a lot of graphical notation because it's cute and it's simple. So, you know, if I have a representation vj which comes here with an arrow up, the dual representation goes with an arrow down, and you see that the fact that there's a pairing just tells me that I have the natural identity between the two, which is just this line. The pairing between vj and vj is a pairing which looks less natural. That's why there's this, because it's going to pair two arrows that points into the same direction. Okay. So here I've seen an example of a spin network of an intertwiner. So what is an intertwiner? An intertwiner is between two representation space, U and V, which are, you know, two not necessarily irreducible. When I was talking about this finite dimensional representation, I forgot to mention the fact that they are irreducible representation. They can't be split. There's no invariant subspace that is left invariant by the action of the group. So two representation, and it would be these two representation, let's call it I. It's just a map between U and V, which is a covariant with respect to the group action. So it just means that I of because U is a representation, there's a natural notion of the group acting on this vector space U. And there's also a natural action of the group on the vector space V. And I want these actions to commute. Okay, so that's what an intertwiner is, simply put. So for instance, the scalar product is the simplest intertwiner between two irreducible representations. And as we have seen, if I look for intertwiners between Vi and Vj, well, this guy is zero unless. So the space of intertwiner Hij, which is sometimes denoted the space of homomorphism between Vi and Vj, which are invariant under the action of the group, is empty if I is different from J, and it's just a one-dimensional space if I is equal to J. And of course, this is just the identity. So a representative element there is the identity, and there's a scale which is not fixed because it's a vector space. Now, if I try to be to go to a more complicated case, let me look for the space of intertwiner between Vi, Vj, and Vk. Okay. Okay. Soon. Okay. Let me 5 minutes. Let me 5 minutes. 5 minutes.
Okay, but you need to give me this eraser.
Okay. Don't take my eraser like that. So okay. So the space of intertwiner Hijk, that is of homomorphism, G invariant homomorphism from Vi, tensor Vj to Vk, in this case is in the case of SU2, it's very interesting that this object is just one-dimensional as long as k, is between I plus j and I minus j in modulus here. And then it's empty if k is not in this boundary. And of course, I guess most of you know, a corresponding representative element is an object, a linear map that goes from here. So it carries three labels, G2, G3, and M1, M2, M3. And this object is called a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. And I encourage you to try to prove that it's unique. Essentially, you use the fact that the fact that it's an intertwiner, for instance, the fact that it's an intertwiner with respect to H tells you that the sum of M1 and M2 is equal to M3, right? So this object is zero if M3 is different from M1 plus M2. And then you use the action of sigma plus and sigma minus, which are later operator, to start from some type of highest weight and show that you get a unique coefficient. So up to a general coefficient there. But in general, for general group, this is not the case, but we're not going to use that. So it's not exactly the right place to stop. I'm going to stop soon. But let me go just one next example, which is, let me try to understand. For instance, if I have such a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, and such a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, if I use the duality I was talking about, I can also think about as an invariant map that goes from the dual representation, you know, VI, VJ, VJK to the symmetric one. And a graphical notation for this object is that I have VI, I have VJ, and then it fuses into VK. And here, I have VI, VJ, but then, you know, by duality, the duality is just an object that allows me to change the arrow of the edges. So if I have such a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, I can compose them. So I can go from VI tensor VJ to VK and then to VP tensor VQ. Okay? So this object is, if I compose two intertwiners here, C and C prime, this object is also going to be an intertwiner which belongs to the space of homomorphism VI tensor VJ into VP tensor VQ. And graphically, what I'm using, I'm with representation IJ going into representation K, and then going into representation PQ. And that's an intertwiner. It commutes with the action of the group because I compose two maps that do commute with the action of the group. The interesting thing that is used all over and over and over again is the fact that this space, not only I have that such intertwiners are, you know, part of this space of homomorphism, but if I look at the space of intertwiners that intertwine four representation, I can get all of them by doing this composition. So if I sum over all k going from I minus j to I plus j, this intertwiner these two spaces are isomorphic. So this type of intertwiner form a total basis of the space of all intertwiners of four elements. And then you can, the way you prove that is essentially that you want to prove that VI tensor VJ is equal to the sum over K going from I minus J to I plus J of VK. And first, it's clear that this one is embedded into that one as a group representation. This is the fact that there is an intertwiner there. And then you compute that the dimension is the sum of dimension of DK, and since they're a finite dimensional space, that's the right thing. So one thing which is used all the time, and that's going to be the last one, is that suppose I want to compute something which is the identity, the tensor product of two, you know, the identity on I and the identity on J. I can use this completeness relation here. So first, I know that because of this theorem, tells me that I can always expand it in terms of these spaces, ij, ij. Okay, this is clearly an intertwiner, so I can always expand it in terms of these spaces, I have to tell you what are the coefficients here, and the coefficients that arise here are just the dimension of the representation. I have to tell you also how I normalize this object. So when I write this identity, I always use a normalization, which is the simplest one, which is the fact that when you compute the theta graph, that is the contraction of two such elements, I fix the normalization coefficient such that this object is just one or zero, depending on whether k is into I and j or zero. And if you normalize it like that, you can show that this identity is correct. Well, let's let that as an exercise, and then we can do. Let me stop here. I wanted to do more, but okay. Can't I just define? I need to define the spin network functional. I've talked about that, but this is an idea, and I will start that from there after. Now, you want to know that. I mean, I've done all this boring representation theory. It's at least you want to know what a spin network functional is. Don't you? Yeah. No? Well, okay, so how do you use all this data to construct this spin network functional? So I have a graph, you know, which is labeled, which is oriented, and each edge is labeled by a representation, and each vertex is carrying G1, G2, G3, is labeled by an intertwiner here. So associated to each edge, I can take the I'm using my graphical notation. I can take the representation of the group element GE in the representation J, and with vectors M and N on the boundary. So you assign such an object. Okay. So now, if I do the tensor product of all these objects, it belongs to a vector space, which is a VJ tensor. VJ dual. Each of these matrix is just an endomorphism on VJ, so it belongs to VGE tensor VGE dual, and then I'm making the tensor product of all edges there. Now I want to assign to any vertex there, clearly what I'm going to assign, suppose it's a trivalent object here, I want to assign an intertwiner, which is a map from all the incoming edge, the tensor product of all the incoming edge, to the tensor product of all the outgoing edge. Which I can view as a tensor product over E of the incoming tensor, the outgoing star. Okay? And then if you count, of course, each edge has two ends, you know, and each end arises one in one vertex. So if I take the tensor product of this intertwiner, it belongs to the tensor product of all vertices of, and for each vertices, I take the tensor product of all incoming edge and outgoing edge. And clearly, each edge has two ends, and so these two spaces are isomorphic, right? In fact, they are dual to each other because the space which is outgoing for the edge is incoming for the vertex. So I can construct a spin network functional associated to this data, which depends on G, which is just the duality pairing between these two objects. And tensor V of IV.
You need to put a dual on the outgoing.
Well, I put it there, so somehow. Okay. So this, yeah, that's what I'm saying. This one is incoming, and this one is outgoing. So depending on how I do it, I can just pair them. Okay. So for instance, if I. Okay, just an example, and it's done. This guy, that's what the example I started from in the beginning. So you know, this guy, what it is? It's I put a group element here, which is DJ, one edge, and then the contraction here, which is just the identity matrix, right? So what I'm computing here is the character, the trace in the dimension representation G. And if I look at this object here, G1, G2, G3, then the corresponding functional is the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient here, the matrix element, the product over I of matrix element, and the conjugate Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. Or let's say the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient for the conjugate representation. Okay? So with that, I hope it's clear what a spin network functional is. And I stop.